Hello, hello, this is Tyler, and you are listening to the Analytive Podcast. Today, I have Alex Stewart from Premier Body Armor on the podcast today. This was a really fun podcast for me. I've been a fan of Premier Body Armor and what they have been building for the everyman, for everyday carry, for quite a while. They do backpack panels that'll stop a 9mm handgun round that are just a pound and a half, super duper light. They're really innovating in the space. And in a world that sometimes seems a bit crazy, it's nice to have just, what they provide. And so I reached out to Alex. He sponsored another podcast that I was listening to. And I said, hey, you should come on. You should talk about your business, talk about what you're up to. And so we riff on that. We riff on family business. So he is the president of the company that his dad started. And so we talk about family business and how he's thinking about business now with his own kids. We talk about launching an e-commerce store, what he learned in the process, especially somebody who went from government contracting to e-commerce, a very different world. And we talk about running a great business, also in a bit of a banned area a little bit, or at least with some regulations around it. So we dive into that and a ton more on this podcast. So without further ado, here is my interview with Alex Stewart of Premier Body Armor. Alex, hey, thanks for coming on the Analytive Podcast today.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here. Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah, I'm excited for this conversation. We talked a little bit before. I found you guys before I had met you through email. I found your company in 2022. So real quick, my body armor journey, which is a funny thing to say, I think summer of 2020, things in the country got a little weird for a while. If anybody remembers that summer. So I bought my first, I was like, oh, maybe I should try a backpack panel. I didn't buy it from you guys. I bought it from a competitor, and it was steel. So it weighed like 10 pounds. I got it in the mail and I was like, you know, I'm not going to carry this. Like there's no way. And that kind of started me on this journey. And then I found you guys in summer of 2022. And so you make some super innovative products. I bought my first, I think one panel initially, and then quickly added a couple more. I have the panel in my bag right over here somewhere. It goes with me everywhere I go. My wife has one. We have one in our baby bag, and I bought one for my mother-in-law. So, you know, not sponsored, but I love what you guys are doing. And so when the opportunity came up for us to chat, I was happy to do that.
Well, thank you. That's awesome. Yeah. I mentioned before we got on, I got on our website in the back end of the website and I saw your orders from before. So I appreciate you being a customer and especially having me on. That's awesome. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So talk about a little bit about Premier Body Armor, right? For somebody who's never heard of you guys, like what is Premier Body Armor? I mean, like part of it's in the name, but I'd like for you to break that down a little bit.
Sure. Premier Body Armor is of course, a body armor company. We got started in 2013, but that really got started off the back of a previous company that my dad started and owned for about 25 years. That was called Ultra Machine and Fabrication. It was in Shelby, North Carolina. He started with just himself and maybe one other guy, and they were just machining small parts for any business they could get. And just a great business mind, really, really intelligent on the machining side of things, come up with clever solutions, did a great job, high quality. All those things led to him growing that company to the size where they could have a really large facility with a really large team and sustain government contracts. So they were able to become subprime contractors, DOD contracts related to armored vehicles. So they took their initial know-how in basic steel parts and machining basic steel parts, and they got into machining fabricating like armor parts, right? So they could take full sheets of armor steel, super hard stuff, and bend it and weld it and turn it into the capsule of basically an IED proof truck. They built tons of those. They also did a lot of armored traditional vehicles like Toyota Hiluxes and other trucks that also were sent overseas. And all this is during the war in Iraq, Afghanistan. And so that was great. Big business, much bigger than today. We have a smaller family-owned operation here. That's just a few of us. But that kind of set the stage. He learned a lot, gained a lot of insight into armor, particularly steel armor, then, and right at the end, the tail end of Ultra, before he sold the business, they started playing around with the idea of try to come up with a revolutionary steel plate. So lighter and a better shape and fit. And they ended up getting a process patent on the process for manufacturing an armor steel chest plate. So it was a 10 by 12 sappy shape plate that actually had a traditional sappy curve on it, which is super hard to do in armor steel because armor steel is so hard. So they had to come up with a process of heating it and then bending it. And it had this crazy overbend. They had to bend it super far and it would spring back into the correct shape because the steel was just so tough. And then they had to heat it again to get back to hardness level that could actually withstand rifle rounds, right? And that was a really cool level 3 plate. They sold a bunch of those. And then all of a sudden, polyethylene kind of took the armor market by a storm. And you could get down to, 3 pounds roughly for a rifle rated plate that'll stop 308 and 556. And that's the future, right? Back 10 years ago, we saw that and we were like, this is the future. Steel plates are, they'll always be around as a budget option, as a great starting point. But they pale in comparison in almost every way to more advanced materials. So we quickly added in, we actually started off with soft armor vests to complement the steel plates and then the polyethylene plates. And then we started getting our law enforcement clients were saying, hey, what about off-duty solutions? We wear our vests during the day, but we need stuff off-duty. What about even products for our wives and children? Our families need to be safe as well. And we were like, we haven't addressed that at all yet. So this would have been probably, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, towards the beginning, when we said, why don't we take a ballistic panel and cut it into the shape of a backpack and make an insert that you can just move from backpack to backpack. So you don't have to be stuck with any certain bag. You can take it wherever you want. You can move from a diaper bag, like you said, over to a work bag. And that kind of kicked this this ball rolling down the hill that's just never stopped for us of trying to incorporate armor into everyday life. So now that we have Premier and I think we're becoming well established as a brand, our goal really is to come up with innovative ways for law-abiding citizens here in the U.S., and even abroad to just have armor with them all the time in discreet ways, just so they have that layer of security with them wherever they go.
Yeah, that's awesome. And your panels are, again, I've bought them and I love them. You can fly with them. Like I've taken them through TSA. Like it's, I'm trying to explain it to somebody who's never seen it, right? Like it's kind of like foam, but like a lot thicker. I mean, how would you describe it?
Yeah. For somebody who's never seen a ballistic panel, that would be like for a backpack. I would say it is so on the outside, the exterior of the panel is Cordura. So it's like a rugged nylon material that's super durable. And then one layer in is a waterproofing layer. So you don't have to worry about getting your armor wet or anything. And then the core of the panel is the actual armor, which in most cases is going to be some form of Kevlar, some woven material. And it's going to be in layers, it's going to be stitched together. And that is the actual part that's going to stop a round, of course, if the panel is rated for that round. So our backpack panels, for example, that makeup that I just mentioned will stop up to a 44 Magnum handgun and 12-gauge slugs as well from shotgun. And special threat tested to a couple other things also. But the majority, if you look at the data, the majority of gun-related violence in the U.S. is just heavily skewed to handguns. The news might make you want to think otherwise, that rifles are walking around the streets everywhere, but it's just not true. Most violence with firearms in the U.S. is handguns, and then shotguns are in there a little bit, and then rifles are way down on the list. So if you have this little piece of armor with you all the time, you have just have a huge advantage in case you were to encounter that unlikely situation of a handgun being pointed your way.
For sure. So circling back to the vehicle armor you guys did, 15 years ago, like, did you ever do the armored Humvees? Was that in, or were you mostly doing like Hiluxes? What were the vehicle loadouts you were doing?
Yeah, no Humvees, because the Humvees were being up armored.
Right.
And the problem was, although that was a great attempt at the start, the problem was they had a flat bottom, right? And they're a rather lightweight vehicle. So it was really easy to defeat an up armored Humvee with an IED blast. That flat bottom basically just launches up, right? Or it even like concaves, and the blast just goes right through. So the real key to having an IED proof truck is to have that V-shaped hole made of armor that deflects the blast energy away from the center of the cab where everyone is. And that's really what defeats it. So we didn't do any Humvees, but the Hiluxes were one of the, you could say, up armored vehicles. You totally rip out the interior, the floor panels, the seats, everything, and you put armor all around in the ceiling and the floor and the doors. And depending on the level of armor, you do even more than that. You might do completely new, completely new grill on the front, for example. If you want to watch an interesting video, Demolition Ranch was an account on YouTube.
Yeah.
Cool guy. He got from us via a trade with my dad, our B7 Suburban that was built back in those days. And the grill, the front grill on that truck can take a direct shot from a 308 or 556 or armor piercing rifle round because of the way it's designed. So little things like that just is what makes it into this tank of a vehicle.
Check out that video
because they shoot it.
Now that you mention it, I think I watched, because he did a couple different ones. The first one, he's like, I'm not going to shoot it. And then he immediately shoots it. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
That was 2-3 years ago. I forgot that was you guys that did that. That's awesome.
Yeah. That was a lot of fun. The deal was that he wouldn't shoot it. But then, of course, knowing, Matt, he had to go back and just obliterate the thing. So he did I don't remember how many parts it was, 4 or 5 parts. Started off with handguns, which of course, practically bounce off of it. And then all the way up to a tank round, just blowing through the vehicle. It was pretty entertaining.
Yeah. I love that series. I ask about the Humvee selfishly because I grew up in Northern Indiana, which is the headquarters of AM General, right? Who was the original Hummer manufacturer. So I had family members who worked for that plant and then also did Kuwait, helped with the up armor process and mechanics.
Okay.
And so
cool.
That's my connection there. But anyway, back to your business. How did you get involved in the business? Obviously you said family business. What was your kind of transition in, with your dad, right?
Sure. Well, I was graduating college and I was going to be marrying my now wife, only a few months after graduation. And I was thinking, I need something steady here. We want to build a family together and have kids and stuff. And my degree was actually in discipleship studies. So basically biblical studies, applied Bible study, basically. And I got a couple job offers to be a worship pastor or a pastor elsewhere, but I just didn't feel like I was called to do that. I didn't think God was leading us in that way. So I was just kind of evaluating options. And my dad was like, why don't you come and work for me? You have nothing to lose. You might as well try. You might enjoy it. Business is for you. And I was thinking, let's give it a shot. So immediately out of college, started working with him. I started out in assembly and shipping, putting parts together all day long. And then moved over to website design. And I was working with Jason, who's now our VP of marketing, trying to build a website for e-commerce. From scratch. We'd never done it before. Didn't know anything about it. It was a beast, of a lift, and just trying everything we could on the e-commerce side. Along the way, the law enforcement stuff is kind of keeping the lights on, right? We're selling lots of vests and plates and products to law enforcement. And then once I kind of learned as much as I could on the website side at that point, moved into sales, trying to get dealers established, trying to get product out there. A new sales channel opened up. did that for a while. And then once that was kind of moving along, we had a rep group that was pushing us nationwide. Just kind of took over as VP of sales, more so looking at sales from a high level on e-commerce and on the outside sales side. And then I think going on two or three years ago, I should know, became president of the company and kind of took the reins of leadership over the whole thing. And now we have a good sized team and lots of awesome people here. So that's kind of how I got into it. I don't know if that's a thorough enough answer.
No, that's helpful. I mean, growing up, obviously you shared that, you know, your dad was doing this stuff with armored vehicles and eventually body armor and all that. Were you an active part of the business? Like what was that kind of growing up? Cause my dad was a company man, still is, you know, and it does great work. I love my dad. I definitely didn't grow up with the entrepreneurial side though. So I'm always curious for people whose parents, father, mother, whoever owned a business, like what was that like? Were you active or not active or what'd that look like for you?
Sure. I would say that I was mostly inactive in the business, in either of my parents' businesses. But I did get to see the businesses a lot, right? So I didn't produce, right, in the business. I was just too young at the time in school and stuff. I did a couple summers here and there of, you know, light assembly work, you know, putting screws on armored battery compartments and stuff like that.
Or the $7 an hour. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a little, yeah. cleaning parts and stuff like that, which was a good experience, right? It's good to see how even that little piece matters in the giant truck that's being assembled just down the hall. I didn't get to participate in the building of those businesses per se, but I did get to see the level of effort and the difficulty that my dad had to go through to build that company. Not only him, though, also there's just so many people involved in the success of it, all giving, you know, it was almost 365 days, 24/7, through holidays, everything, just pushing to get these orders out, because we knew that we were saving the lives of warfighters. So it was worth that extra time, right? So I was definitely exposed to the difficulty around entrepreneurship from an early age.
For sure. How are you thinking about that? Because you have a couple of little kids, like, you know, as you think about the next generation, I know they're super young. Maybe you're not thinking about it yet, but you know, I have a 2-year-old and 1-year-old right now, one's about to be 3. And I'm starting to think about this, like I don't have any action steps or anything, but how are you thinking about, you know, next gen business for your kiddos, if you don't mind my asking?
It's definitely been on my mind because there's been several mornings when I've had to leave early, for example, before my kids come down for breakfast. Because every morning we try to eat breakfast together, right? Eggs and bacon. And sure. If my kid will eat the eggs that day, it just depends on the day.
Yeah.
But there's been a couple mornings when I've had to miss breakfast or I'm walking out as the kids are coming down. And my 4-year-old, even at 4, you know, he's like, "Daddy, you're not eating breakfast with us?" And it's just like, oh, it's heartbreaking, you know? And in one sense, I'm like, you know, it's weird when you think about the work week, because a lot of people are at work from, let's just say, 8 to 4 or 5, right? So all that time during the week, you're at work away from your kids. And then you're asleep for most of the time during the week. And then you only get those few hours before and after work with your family. So, and then, of course, the weekend, hopefully, for most people, or a couple days off. So it's definitely been on our minds to consider. And I don't really like the phrase work-life balance, just because I think phrases like that end up getting overused and then it just goes downhill from there. But there definitely is truth behind it. There has to be some sort of balance if you want to have that long-term relationship, because the long-term relationship with your kids starts in the early years for most people. In some instances, you kind of get away with it and you still end up with a great relationship down the road, right? Sure. But for most people, if you want to have that relationship one day with your kids, the formative years really do matter. That's where you get to know each other. That's where you get to have a big influence on them. So as much as we can, we're trying to implement little things along the way to help kind of ease the burden, right? So an example would be my wife found, I think it was a recommendation from my friend. She found a cool toy for our kids called a Yodo player, which this isn't an advertisement necessarily for Yodo players, but basically it's a little radio and your kid can take a card that has either music or a book or a story or jokes or something on it, and they can stick it in the Yodo player and it plays whatever's on it. But what's really cool about the Yodo player is they have cards you can make yourself. So you can use your phone to record something, say reading a bedtime story. And then if you know you're going to be gone, your kid can take that card and put it in the Yodo player and have you, your voice, reading a bedtime story to them. So no matter what, you know, business event you're at or whatever you have to do for your business, your kid can still be that a little bit more connected to you while you're gone. So we are doing our best to do little things like that to try to bridge that gap so that we can, you know, try to have the best relationship possible with our kids, I suppose.
For sure. That's awesome. I've not heard of that. So I'm after the call, I'm going to Google it here. So let's talk about the e-commerce journey that you guys went on. So you went from, you know, DoD contracts, which are not at all e-commerce, right, to gradually moving into selling online. That had been what, 2013, 2014? Like, when did you really kick off your e-commerce push?
No, e-commerce push would have been like 17.
Okay, so a couple of years later. What did you big themes for a company who may be going through that or is thinking about e-commerce and hasn't done it before? Like, what were the big takeaways, the big learnings that you guys went through to get that off the ground from somebody who had never done it before?
Sure. Oh, man, that's a big answer to that. E-commerce is it can be simple to get started, but it's very, very complex to master, I would say. There's just tons and tons of stuff to consider. But that shouldn't be a reason not to start if you have a good business plan. And I don't mean like written down on paper. I mean, like if you know your product has good margin, for example, those kinds of things that should be a given before you start a business. If those things are good, then e-commerce can definitely be this crazy tool that allows you to remove the overhead of a brick and mortar retail store, basically, is the main difference. And of course, you have more potential eyeballs that you could get to your website. Getting them there is another story, which I know is one of your expertise, Tyler, but starting up the e-commerce was interesting for us because our initial website actually was locked down. You had to provide law enforcement credentials to even view the content on the website. That's how, like, day one when me and Jason arrived, that's what the website was. So Jason was like, "Look, we got to change this. Let's quickly, you know, move on to some website builder platform and manage this ourselves." We ended up choosing Shopify, and we're still on Shopify today. Actually, it's a great platform to get started on because it's really friendly if you're not a developer, which I'm not, and neither is Jason. So we hopped on there. We built a site that we thought looked cool, and started adding products in, you know, slowly over time. And then that's really when the can of worms gets opened and you start hearing things like SEO, you start hearing things like paid advertisement and, you know, UX and UI and all these different factors that play in, right? So that's kind of when it gets a little scary in e-commerce, unless for some reason your website just blows up. Like if you're an influencer already on social media and you start up a website, you got a great head start. You can probably just push a bunch of traffic to it. But if you don't have that, then it's a little bit more, it's a little bit scarier at start because you build a website and you're like, where are the people at? You know, when are they coming? Right. And like for us, we made the mistake of not, although people told us to, we made the mistake of not investing in SEO early enough. So we didn't get the full benefit of having a strong SEO program until a year ago, maybe even, right? Like it takes a while, especially at the beginning, because you don't have a lot of resources to devote to SEO. And so now we were able to kind of fast track the SEO process just by funding it pretty hard. And now we're in a good spot. We're pretty much in the best spot amongst our competitors. No one's no one can touch our SEO right now. But for 9 years, we paid the price of not focusing on it and not getting the benefit from it. So I would say that's at the start. I think going, if we could restart, I would say I would have put some percent of effort into SEO, along with the other things that I would be working on. That would be a key thing that I would recommend people do. Even if it's just starting with blogs and like your basic on page, like meta tags and stuff like that, at least get started there, you know? And then as soon as you can, hire somebody who actually knows what they're doing, and at the very least learn it from them and then do it yourself. If not, just keep them on if it works out.
Yeah. It's funny because I was having a conversation with a potential client yesterday, and you know, it reminds me of that, I think it's what a Chinese proverb of like, when's the best time to plant a tree? Like 20 years ago, the next best time is today. SEO exactly. is 100% that, right? Like, yes, if you,
yes.
the sooner you start, the better, you know, swallow the frog, like whatever analogy you want to use, but like get started. And then, yeah, you get that flywheel spinning, and then it actually gets easier as you get more domain authority and you have that content background, right?
That's right.
Again, assuming you're not like spamming or doing anything crazy. So.
Yeah. And I'm not even an expert. Like I wouldn't say the business owner needs to be the expert in the SEO field. Like that would take a lot of learning, a lot of years of experience. But we did, we found a guy who we knew was an expert because his own website ranked appropriately and really highly for his topic area. And he was willing, you know, to consult with us and basically teach a couple of our staff how to do SEO really well from like a strategy perspective and into the nitty gritty. So there's probably different options out there for people to consider, either hiring a full-time company to just take care of it for you and make sure it's professional and make sure it's done right from the start, or try to learn it yourself or have someone in your team learn it. And it takes a little bit longer, but maybe that works too.
Yeah, absolutely. So what, as you got started on e-commerce, talk about kind of, I guess when you went from pure law enforcement to like consumer focused, you talked about obviously you had a gated website, all of that. Did you start just jumping with both feet on e-commerce? You know, were you doing a lot of like, you know, get this in whatever sporting goods stores and things? Like what was that sort of transition? What did that look like for you?
We did jump in pretty hard to e-commerce as far as the amount of hours of effort we put in. And I would say the website was probably running, if my memory is correct, website was up and running for a little while, a couple of years probably before we really went out and tried to get dealers and stuff. So we were relying on the website pretty heavily for growth there, for new growth.
Okay. And then you guys are, I mean, Body Armor is in a unique spot, right? It's not traditionally been heavily regulated. Is there any, you know, stories, have you dealt with any challenges either using platforms or, you know, with cancel culture, anything like that? Or have you guys, you know, knock on wood, right, kind of been able to get by without any issues there?
Yeah, we have, unfortunately. For example, we can't sell on Amazon at all. Body Armor is not allowed to be sold on Amazon. So that's a big stream of revenue for a lot of companies that we can't touch, which I think is silly. I mean, Body Armor is inert. It's not like it's going to hurt somebody, but whatever.
Fundamentally,
we have our own views on that.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm not going to try to battle Amazon on their policy. I think I'm going to lose that fight. We did, though. However, we had Amazon. I think it's called Amazon Pay, whatever their payment processor was. We had that on our Shopify for a while because it's native there. You just turn it on, and their policy on Amazon Pay specifically does not address Body Armor outright. So for a while, we used it, and it was great. And then eventually, someone at Amazon said, no. And they you know, turned it off and then held some money from us for a while, and we had kind of battled in there. So there's been a little bit of cancel culture here and there. But luckily for Body Armor, we've been able to just try not to be really, like, overtly tactical about it. Like, we don't have AR-15s. We don't have big giant, like we have a machine gun, like an actual 50 cal machine gun we could use for photos and stuff. That would be really cool. But if we do that, then Shopify might not be happy about it, you know, that kind of thing. So it's an unfortunate reality for us being adjacent to weapons, you know, I suppose. We do have to be a little bit more careful than someone selling makeup, for example, sure. or apparel or something. Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, I was curious if you guys had dealt with any of that. So then back to your experience, you talked about theology, right? Like, was your biblical studies useful, not useful? Like, what did you take away from that? Because that's a different path. Sure. Obviously, you know, you're probably not going to have much on the operational side. How has that shaped, though, how you approach business?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think someone who's on the side of arguing for discipleship would say that you can disciple anyone, anywhere, anytime, you know, that kind of answer, which is true. But I think it probably mostly in a business context helped me with my writing. It's pretty decent, with communications. I think I had somewhat of a foundation, all that in that, although I had to learn a lot of like leadership, interpersonal communications. And I'm still learning that today. Still paying the price for mistakes in that area today sometimes.
Aren't we all?
And then lastly, I think it definitely helps give a, helped me have a different worldview, I suppose, that I can, you know, being in a free country can bring into our business. And I'm grateful for that. We're able to live out our foundational Christian faith throughout our business in cool ways. Like we, because of our faith, for example, we highly value families. Like we really would love to see any of our employees, who want to have children be able to do that. We want to help empower them to do that. So we recently instituted a little benefit perk, that just helps with a little extra funding for families who have a newborn, right? So stuff like that is cool. I think, I guess to answer your question now the short way after I went the long way around would be that it just helped formulate, you know, our foundational view for what our business should accomplish.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Cause I did business in a Christian university setting. So that was my background.
Oh,
so
cool.
It was definitely more operator focused, but I think even having that, you know, theological underpinning, right? And just your faith in general, not necessarily the formal education, for me has been, you know, trying to operate with integrity, right? And everybody says that, but like trying to really, like, what does it look like to manifest this, like care for your team and do all that?
Yeah, exactly.
For me. Cool. Back to the products, because our audience is definitely business focused, so probably has little to no, I don't know, tactical, whatever word you want to use. So
sure.
Let's talk through, because body armor, when you get into it, I mean, I was super confused because there's like 3A and 4 and 2 and A and levels and different rounds and all of this. Like, start, you know, big picture and you know, take us in. We talked a little bit about steel versus, you know, polyethylene versus Kevlar. But like, what are all these ratings? Like, can you demystify this a little bit for somebody?
Definitely. So, caveat, because all this is about to change next year. Okay. A new standard is coming out next year called NIJ 07, which will be new testing standards. So basically, the gist of it is law enforcement needs testing standards in place to verify that body armor is of high quality and will perform in the line of duty. So this set of standards was written to make sure that the armor that was being produced for law enforcement use would be able to stop common threats that law enforcement encounters on duty, right? And then, of course, anything, it's like with the military, anything that's popular in the military gets pushed down into the civilian tactical market, right? So it's the same thing here. The standards that are used with law enforcement to keep them safe get pushed down into civilian market as well. And those standards is really, there's several, but really the three main ones that civilians are concerned about would be in ascending order of stopping power would be level 3A, level 3, and level 4. Level 3A stops handguns and shotguns, and there's some specifics there. And then level 3 stops common rifle threats. like a 5.56, which would be like what an AR-15 would shoot, and then a 308, which is a common hunting round. And then level four is more geared towards military applications where you have like armor piercing threats, 30-06 AP, really nasty round right there. You're not going to see that really ever here stateside, I don't think. So unless something really bad happened, but
sure,
we'll let the preppers consider that, I suppose. So really it's really two, 3A and level three. So handgun, shotgun, or rifle threats. And both of those levels can be applied to products, or products can be built to those levels that are practical for everyday life. So when I say body armor, most people probably think of either a knight in shining armor, or they think of a soldier, you know, in their full uniform and kit. But whenever we say body armor at Premier, we have the full kit in mind, right, for law enforcement and military stuff over here. But on this hand, we also have in mind the average civilian, and that body armor application looks a lot different. It's 9 out of 10 times going to be just handgun and shotgun rated, and it's going to be in a really discreet form, such as my favorite one that we have is our bulletproof laptop case, right? It's just it looks just like a normal laptop case that you would buy on Amazon, but it has armor built right into it, and you don't notice the armor. Like when you open it, you don't see the armor. It's just it's inside. But all you do is just slide your laptop in there, put your charger in the front pocket, go into Starbucks and, you know, enjoy your coffee. And, you know, God forbid someone comes in to do some evil stuff, you have practically a shield with you. So it's basically, I like to compare it to having a security system at your house. It's really unlikely that your home's going to be broken into. The data is very, very small. But a lot of people have a security system at their house just in case, right? It's a layer of protection. So this ballistic laptop case or backpack insert, similar products are just like that. You're super unlikely to ever use them. But if you need to, it's right there. It's ready.
Yeah, it's like flood or fire insurance, right? Like that's how I think about it. And sure. What you guys have done is you've made it so easy. Like I actually, my backpack has better rigidity and stands up better. Like I actually like my backpack better with the insert in it than I do without. Like that's how discreet and lightweight it is. It's not something where I'm like, oh my goodness, I got to take this everywhere. Yeah, it adds a little bit of weight, but I like how it just, blends into like our lifestyle and we don't even think about it, but it's there, you know, again, in the very unlikely chance we would ever need it.
Yeah, it's flexible, it's soft, it weighs like a pound or a pound and a half, depending on the size. I mean, you just don't, as an adult, you just don't notice it, you know? You just have it when you need it.
Yeah. So so what's the testing process like, right? So you have all these levels, you know, you have kind of the formal, I'll let you talk about it. I imagine there's probably internal testing and then probably external, like, you know, testing qualifications you guys do. What does that look like for you guys?
So we talked about NIJ a little bit. The formal testing protocol for NIJ for like a ballistic vest that you would sell to law enforcement is really intense. You have to send a lot of armor. It's very expensive. They shoot it a lot of times, but before they even shoot it, they do some conditioning on it where they heat it, cool it, put it in a tumbler, depending on the type of armor that you're talking about. All these things are a list of things that could happen to simulate wear and tear for 5 years at least.
Like left in a hot car, every patrol car every day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The tumbling process is really intense. I mean, it simulates 5 years of normal wear and tear, like wearing the armor every day. And then at the very end, they put it on a clay block. So you got clay on the back. It's at a certain temperature. It does a pretty good job of replicating the human body. And when you shoot that armor, not only are you looking for it to stop the round, but you're also looking for it to defeat, or I guess to suppress the energy that's going to be absorbed into the clay block, which would be you if you're wearing it. And that needs to be, what they do is they take the armor off, and assuming it didn't penetrate all the way through, they're going to take a measurement of the cavity in the clay. And that has to be within a certain millimeter metric. I think right now it's less than 42 millimeters or so. Because any deeper than that and you risk internal damage to the person wearing it, that would be life-threatening. So that's like the official, I'm giving an unofficial version of the official testing protocol. All that stuff is online, actually, if someone's really curious about how it all works. And then you take it a step back, and a common practice would be, if you wanted to just make sure a product works really well, but you don't necessarily want to certify it officially, you can send your products to specific third-party labs, ballistic labs, and they'll do this, the shooting portion that we're talking about, where they'll put it on clay, do all the science stuff to make sure the ammo is going right, or the round's going the right speed, everything's loaded properly. They do the measurement of the back face, deformation, and all that stuff. And you can get a report that you can give to your customer and say, hey, we tested this in an independent lab. It's very scientific, and this is the results. And then, of course, all stepping all the way back would be just to take it out on our range, on our property, and put it up against the rubber dummy and shoot it. And we can shoot it a bunch of times and just to show, look, this stuff really works, you know? And then maybe the furthest back would be sending it to Matt at Demo Ranch and letting him shoot it with the tank, you know, see what happens there.
Totally. So for you guys, do you... Obviously, you, I'm sure, have this down to a science. Like, are you kind of 3D modeling and doing like a lot of, you know, estimation up front? Or is it, you know how many layers typically of Kevlar, I assume, would stop a 9mm or whatever? Like, how do you, when you're developing products, what does that look like?
Yeah, so for soft armor, it's pretty simple because the recipes are known. Okay. And unless you're developing something new, like you're trying to mess around with weight or thickness and you're combining different materials, all that's possible. So it's actually pretty simple. I said what I mean to say is that the process is pretty rudimentary still, where it starts on paper even a lot of the time, and then you work your way up from there. There's no CAD involved or anything like that for soft armor, not typically. You might have some drawings online, but nothing crazy. And then helmets, for example, might be a bit different. Or you might go down the road of actually doing the full on CAD drawings and 3D modelings and all that stuff, because you got to build a mold, and then you're gonna have to press that mold at certain temperatures and pressures. And you really wanna make sure it's very precise before you go down the road of making a mold, right? Any snags or anything in the mold and you're gonna have a problem. So differing levels of complexity amongst all the products.
For your poly stuff, what does that look like? I mean, is that similar where everything's kind of known, or are you guys kind of developing your own, I don't know, recipe for, you know, layman's term there?
Poly blades usually comes down to raw materials, which if you're buying quality stuff, that's going to be somewhat of a given, and then machinery, right? So you're talking really large presses that... somewhat of where the magic happens there is in the heating and cooling of the material while it's under pressure. So there's some secret sauce there, right? Sure. That everybody does a little bit differently. But those machines are built to, it's like a press machine right here. And then there's the cooling, the heating and cooling unit off to the side that regulates all of that. What you're trying to do is get the crystallization of the structure of the polyethylene right when you heat it and cool it. That's layman's terms of how, because if you make the plate too hard, it'll be brittle and it won't be able to withstand a round. If you make it too soft, then obviously it won't stop the round. The round will just go through. So that's kind of where the ply count of the material might be known. But how exactly you process the material is more where the secret sauce lies from manufacturer to manufacturer.
Interesting. That makes a lot of sense. I know very little about this, but I find it super intriguing, because obviously there's a lot of companies doing, especially on the traditional body armor, the plate side. So I wondered what that secret sauce is, that, you know, all of them are slightly different weights and thicknesses. So that makes sense. You guys have obviously your own proprietary heating process. I still don't see a lot of companies doing what you're doing with the backpack armor though, which for me, like, you know, I'm not G.I. Joe, right? I'm not running around in a plate carrier or anything like that. And so I, like I said, I, those are the panels that I love what you guys are doing. Although I do have my eye on some of the level four stuff I think you just released, which is really cool.
Sure. Yeah. And the background panels have kind of been our bread and butter for a while. Just cause it is so accessible. We have a huge inventory. I could, if I could take my computer down there and show you, I would, but there's just tons of different sizes and shapes for all sorts of bags, everything down to a real small fanny pack panel up to like a really large, 3-day hiking pack panel. Right. So I'm glad you enjoy it. And this has been a good one for us.
Yeah. It's a, you know, peace of mind for me. USA Manufacturing, you guys do, I think, just about all of your manufacturing in the US. What is that like? I mean, what are you seeing? It's kind of an open-ended question, but like pros, cons,
sure.
What's working for you, what's not?
Yeah. So we've tried to keep as much manufacturing stateside as possible. And what we've kind of ended up doing is having all of our soft armor made in the US of US materials. That's probably not ever going to change, just because soft armor is it's kind of finicky. You really do need the raw material to be super high quality for the armor to perform without making it extremely thick. You know, you could make an armor panel that's, you know, an inch and a half thick, and it's probably going to stop just about anything. But nobody wants to wear that. It's super heavy. It's super uncomfortable. So to keep it as a good functioning product, we need to keep all of those materials stateside, and we want to do that. The hard plate side of things, it's a little bit different because you can get raw materials that are US made, that are really high quality, and just press them overseas. We avoid China, just for the record. That's important for me to say. We don't want to do any of our products in China, but we can use other resources outside of the States to just do the pressing portion. And unfortunately, it's kind of a reality of our current economic situation as a nation, where we have such little manufacturing infrastructure in certain industries such as armor that, although we have it, it's just very expensive with very, very similar, if not the same, machinery elsewhere to produce similar products, as long as the raw materials that you start with are good. Yeah. So it's hard to compete.
Sure. The cost you're seeing for your business, is it on, obviously materials are going to be the same. Is it on machinery? Is it labor? All the above? Like where is it more competitive for you guys, you know, elsewhere?
Sure. Materials where we get good competitive pricing on, because we buy a good bit of materials, but labor is the one, you know, it's hard to even compare the labor rates, you know, totally, stateside and elsewhere. So,
and we use, I mean, for a big difference. ICO stuff, we use overseas contractors, like, cause yeah, it's tough to compete, right? And provide products somebody wants to pay for sure.
Sure.
What else are you guys working on? Anything you want to tease or just highlight that you just released over there?
Yeah, we just released our Fortis line of products. This is a line of plates that are a bit more economical than our previous line, which we still have most of. It's a solid set of plates. We have all of our testing documents online for people to see. People love to see that stuff. And it's exciting because we're trying to make armor available to as many law-abiding Americans as we can, because we just think, like I said, it's important to have that security, that layer of safety there. And so that's an exciting launch. We launched that in January at SHOT Show, and people really loved that. We're going to keep expanding that line throughout the year. That's our newest, latest, and greatest, I suppose.
Yeah. So, like, I was looking at it. It's a level four, so it'll stop, you know, all the things, right? Not literally all the things, but almost any common round. You release this new one that's, you know, $50-$100 cheaper than your old one, because you had what, Stratus before and now Fortis. Like, what's the innovation? What's the difference? Like, for somebody who's kind of looking at both of those, can you break that down?
Sure. The major difference is going to simply be in weight. That's what drives price in the armor game, is weight, really, because you can have a level four plate that weighs between 7 and 8 pounds, which is relatively heavy. That is pretty cost effective because most of the build of that plate is going to be in the ceramic strike face or whatever your strike face material may be. So you have less polyethylene in the back, and polyethylene is the expensive part. So to make a really lightweight level four, you would probably use more polyethylene or a really expensive strike face. So it's all about weight, right? So every ounce you can shave off, the only way you can do that is by using more expensive materials. So that's why the price fluctuates based on mostly weight.
Okay, got it. So it's mostly because they're what, like a half a pound different between kind of those two?
Yeah, maybe even more in one specifically that you're talking about. But the weight plays the biggest part of that for sure.
Great. Cool. What should I have asked that I did not ask? Anything you want to share with our audience around business or body armor or anything?
If you don't have a piece of armor yet, you should get it, whether it's from us or from someone else. I think you should get it from us, just saying. But
sure.
I would recommend it.
Again, not a paid sponsorship. I've spent my own money on it, but I love it.
Yeah. I just think it makes sense. It's such an easy thing to have. It doesn't interrupt your life. We've already talked about this, but I'm pretty passionate about that. I have two young kids myself, a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. And of course, my wife has a panel in the diaper bag, for example, and she takes them out to Target. She takes them out to picnics at the park or whatever. And it gives me some peace of mind while I'm here at the office, 15 or 20 minutes away from them, that if, you know, someone comes around and wants to do something, they have some sort of serious piece of equipment that actually would help in that moment, because there's not really a whole lot of things around that are going to stop a bullet that's coming your way besides body armor. So it just makes a lot of sense to me. It's something everyone should at least consider picking up.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Where can people find out more about you guys, URLs? I know they can Google Premier, but any websites or social media you want to shout out, Alex?
Yeah, Instagram is our main form of social media. It's just Premier Body Armor. Is our handle. And then our website is premierbodyarmor.com. There's tons of information there, lots of blogs if you want to learn more about some of the things we've talked about here. And then reach out to info@premierbodyarmor.com if you have any specific questions that you need answered.